So if you put your hands together for a warm welcome.
That would be brilliant.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Before I start, I just want to say a couple of two or three things. First thing is, last night I was in the Jesus Arms and somebody accidentally spilt a pint of beer over me. And they apologise, and I was really ungracious and rude in my response. I doubt that they're here, because why would you come to a talk by someone who's that rude and ungracious? But I just wanted to apologise, because I felt bad, and my friend Julie, who was there at the time, had a little word with me this morning and told me that I was very out of order, so I'm sorry. So if you meet someone who's traumatised by an encounter with a rude woman in the bar, then I'm really sorry. Second thing is... another thing I do is run, and if anybody's interested in running a marathon in Bethlehem next March, Amos Trust, that I'm a trustee of, we're taking a group over to run the Palestine Marathon, and I'm going to be on the Amos stand in G-Source between about 8 and 10, so do come and talk to me about that. It's a fantastic experience. There's a half marathon. If a marathon feels a bit daunting, you can come and do the half. That'd be great. And the third thing is that I'm going to be signing books in the bookshop at 7:30. I've only ever done one book signing before in my life. That was when I did a youth work resource at Spring Harvest and nobody turned up. So I'm thinking the only way is up. Hopefully at least one person might. So, you know, if you're interested in buying my book and getting it signed, that is your moment. But it's really interesting to be doing this talk in this venue, because I'm sure you've seen the installation under the tree there. That is a celebration of women called Half of Us, celebrating the fact that it's 100 years since women won the right to vote. And since that time, in the last 100 years, there's been 369 female MPs. That's in total from 1914 onwards. Compared with the number of men who are currently sitting in the House of Commons, which is 503, that's not a very impressive total, is it? 93% of our MPs since 1914 have been male. And David Cameron recently did a little reshuffle, a little reorganisation to bring more women into his cabinet, perhaps hoping that we would forget that before he was elected, he promised that a third of his cabinet would be female. There's still a very long way to go. Just this week, we heard that the gender pay gap is alive and well. So it's four decades after the Equal Pay Act, and female bosses still earn 35% less than their male colleagues. Many people would say that's to do with women taking maternity leave, but actually, that gender pay gap sets in just a couple of years after graduation. And the pay gap between men and women in their 20s has doubled since 2010. I could go on about ways in which there are disparities between men and women. And at the same time, I'm really aware that in the UK, actually, we're really privileged. There's a lot of legislation in place to promote equality. There's a lot of progress that has been made. If you look at the situation on a global scale, where there's a huge amount of discrimination against women, gender inequality, you know, we're in a much, much better position. And yet it still feels like change is a long time in coming. That needs to be addressed at lots of different levels. But what I want to suggest today is that one of the things that we can do, and one of the things that we should be doing, is talking about and telling the stories of our experiences as men and women in everyday life. We need to catch the sayings and doings of gender, and I'll explain a bit more about what I mean by that as we go on. Do come in if you're standing at the back. There is room down the front if you're interested. Do come in. But before I talk about what I mean by catching the sayings and doings in gender, I just want to talk a little bit about gender in itself and some of the assumptions that I'm making. I'm guessing that Greenbelt is quite an enlightened audience, that you know, a lot of you will have done some thinking about this. Many of you will know a lot more than I do about it. But I just want to tell you that kind of the four basic assumptions, if you like, about gender that I make in giving this talk And you can ask, we'll have some time for questions later on. If you want me to expand on anything, then I can do that later on. So the first one is that in spite of perhaps what the popular narrative would tell us, actually, men and women are more alike than different. We're more alike than different. The Mars and Venus myth that men and women are so different that we might as well have come from different planets and we really struggle to communicate and understand each other is widely discredited. And if you look at research, different aspects of character and ways of being between men and women have been researched and looked into and all that kind of thing. And the big news of that research is actually men and women aren't that different after all. So that there'll always be some mystery around gender, and things like hormones and genes do play a contribution in making us male and female and affecting how we are masculine and feminine. We are embodied people, and our experience is expressed through our physical selves. But overall, there's little doubt that much of gender is created, not constructed. It's down to nurture rather than nature. And so when you see, for example, on the shelves of W.H. Smith, you see a magazine for men called Men's Running and a magazine for women called Women's Running, that's not because men and women are so different and they run so differently that they need separate magazines telling them how to run. That is purely a marketing ploy, and there's a huge amount of that in our society, particularly aimed at children and around toys. So that's the first thing. We're more alike than different, and we need to resist those kind of myths that would tell us otherwise. Secondly, instead of focusing on difference and the difference between men and women, I think there's a real need for us to celebrate the diversity among men and among women. So people are far more complex than narrow definitions of masculinity and femininity allow. There's no one size fits all. There's no one way of being male that all men should aspire to. There's no one way of being feminine that all women should aspire to. And you'll see that when you look around at your friends, at your family, at your colleagues, you'll see a diverse mix of people with different strengths, different talents, different interests, different ways of expressing themselves. So some of them might fit a stereotypical gender norm in some aspects of their life, but they'll probably subvert it in others. And when people complain about the lack of real men in church, as happens from time to time, I heard somebody say that from a platform just a few weeks ago, we need more real men in the church. I want to say, well, which type of man is a real man? Would you like to expand on that? And actually that need to exhort men to discover or rediscover their true manliness only underlines how understandings of what it is to be masculine change over time. And those kind of movements that try to re-establish true femininity or real masculinity are themselves clear evidence that the boundaries that they're trying to defend aren't very stable. Because surely if there was such a thing as true masculinity, then all men would be it, and there wouldn't be the diversity that we see. And I think that diversity is really to be celebrated. It enriches us as people. And instead of, you know, having to fit into a mould, being squeezed into a box, we're free to be ourselves and to be who we are. The third thing I would say about gender is that gender stereotypes aren't just a bit irritating. They can actually be quite destructive and damaging. So if you look at the area of mental health, for example, 75% of the people who commit suicide in the UK are men, and that's a proportion that's stayed fairly constant for the last decade. And I'm sure there's lots of quite complex reasons behind that. I'm not suggesting that, you know, there's one contributing factor to that. But many people would argue that actually something that does contribute to that is that dominant forms of masculinity don't encourage emotional intelligence. And that old adage of big boys don't cry is alive and well. And so campaigns by the Men's Mental Health Forum, for example, pick up on this, and they've done a series of posters with statements on them, such as, men saying, I'd rather admit I like Justin Bieber than admit that I feel crap. And there's an organisation called the Campaign Against Living Miserably, which is aimed at improving the mental health of young men in particular. And they say, we believe there's a cultural barrier preventing men from seeking help, as they're expected to be in control at all times. And failure to be seen as such equates to weakness and a loss of masculinity. And they've run proactive campaigns in areas where they target nightclubs with posters, advertising helplines, and all that kind of thing. And between 2000 and 2009 in Merseyside, where they ran one of these campaigns, there was a 55% reduction in young male suicide. And then if you look at girls, for example, one of the stereotypes I think is very damaging is the use of girl as a pejorative term. So saying to people, you know, don't be a girl, meaning don't be weak, don't be helpless, don't be emotional, and so on. And I don't know if you've seen the adverts by Always Sanitary Protection, which is called Like a Girl. And in it, they get some actors to come in, male and female, adult and young children actors. And they say to them, run like a girl. They're not told, you know, what this whole thing is about. So they say to these adult actors, run like a girl. And, you know, they run like this, really kind of pathetically. And throw like a girl. And they kind of do this little kind of throw like that. And then they say to the girls, the young girls, run like a girl. And they run as fast as they can and throw like a girl. And they throw with great strength. And then they get them talking about, you know, why did you do that? And the adult men and women kind of realise actually what they've done, you know, and what the implications of what that means to see like a girl as a pejorative term. And one of them says, what if run like a girl means to win a race? And I don't know if any of you saw Jo Pavey in her race the other week. It's just incredible competitiveness, speed, determination, absolutely fantastic. Wouldn't it be brilliant if run like a girl meant run like Jo Pavey? But we need to be aware of, you know, how we are perpetuating stereotypes, perhaps, and how we are trying to resist them and subvert them. But we also need to be aware of the impact of stereotypes on our own behaviour and attitudes. So if you hear something like, you know, men are better at maths than women, it can have a different effect on different people. Some people will just shrug it off. Some people will then try and do really well at maths to prove that they're better. I can remember doing, you can get these little tests on the internet that, you know, try and work out whether you've got a male brain or a female brain. And one of them that they ask you to do is those kind of spatial awareness tests where they have 3D shapes and they kind of show them in one position and then they show them in another position and, you know, you have to say which one is like the other one. And women, on the whole, don't do so well in those kind of tests. So when I got to that bit, I tried really, really hard to work it out, to prove that I wasn't stereotypically female. So, you know, sometimes, you know, people will try harder just to prove they're not the stereotype. Other people, it might wash over them. Other people, though, it can have quite a limiting impact on them because there is such a thing as stereotype threat. So, for example, that statement that men are better than maths at women, that is true if you look at kind of the whole of the mathematical world. And Sian Baylock is a psychologist, and she recruited a load of female university students and asked them to do a test and to take a maths test. And one group was told that the purpose of the research was to understand why men do better at maths than women, and the others were just asked to do the test. And the women in the first group, who were reminded that men are better at maths than women, actually did 10 to 15% worse in the test than the women who weren't told anything. And that kind of result has been replicated in things like groups of older people. So older people who are asked to do a memory test, if they're reminded before they do the test that your memory fails with age, they do worse in the test than those that aren't. So it's something, it's not just a gender thing, it's kind of replicated in other areas. But people have shown that actually These kinds of stereotypes can be really damaging in the way that we then react to other people. So teachers, for example, in school, girls and boys from a very young age will expect the boys to be naughty and the girls to be better. But actually, that result has also been shown in teachers as well, in some teachers, that, you know, some teachers expect boys to be naughtier than they do girls. And that kind of thing. So we just need to be aware of how these stereotypes, we might think they don't affect us, but actually they can have an impact on our own behaviour and our own attitudes. And the fourth thing I would say is that life is much more richly complex than a gender binary. So it's very easy to talk about men and women and those categories, but actually life is much more complex than that. There are five indicators of sex in our bodies, and in the vast majority of us, those are all in alignment. But I think it's about 1 in 100 people actually have one of those indicators out of alignment. And so their bodies aren't exactly like somebody who's fully male or fully female. And that's far more common than we expect. So I will talk about men and women, but life is more complex than that. And also gender, of course, isn't the only site of inequality in our society or our world. People suffer discrimination and inequality for all kinds of reasons. So gender, but also disability, age, ethnicity, sexuality, faith, class, and so on. And often those categories are interact with each other to compound that discrimination and disadvantage. So, for example, boys at the moment are doing less well overall at school, at all levels of education now, than girls. So they're not achieving the same kind of academic results. But if you look at that, it's actually, you can break that down and look at how different types of boys are doing. And it's white working class boys who are doing the worst. Whereas actually some types of boys from different ethnic groups are doing really, really well. So again, you know, we need to be aware of the kind of complexities and intersectionality, the kind of compound way that disadvantages play against each other, and the multiple systems of oppression that we suffer from. We need to be very aware of those things as well, and that's something to be bear in mind as we kind of continue. So, four assumptions, if you like, about gender, that we're more alike than we are different, that there's a huge diversity among men and among women, that stereotypes can be really damaging and destructive, and that, you know, we're really complex people and there's a lot more to it than perhaps meets the eye. But getting back to this thing of telling stories and the importance of telling stories, let me tell you a story about Ted and Betty. Okay, so Ted is the CEO of a very successful business, and Betty is a member of his senior executive team. And Ted and Betty are talking in the corridor of their offices one day about the strategy for the company, kind of the challenges that they're coming up against, what they're going to do, how they're going to face them, and all that kind of thing. And they're in the middle of a conversation, and the phone rings in Ted's office. And Ted says to Betty, "Could you get that for me?" And Betty goes to answer the phone and then, you know, takes a message. And she comes back and they kind of look at each other and they say, "What just happened there?" Now, on the surface, that is one person doing a kind thing for another person, answering the phone for them. But they were both aware that actually that wasn't what had just happened. There was something else going on as well. Although they were peers in the company, Ted had just spoken to Betty as if she was his secretary, and she had just responded as if she was his secretary. They kind of slipped into a different dimension for a moment and kind of responded in that way. And Ted prided himself on being egalitarian, being very equal in his dealings with different members of staff. But in this unguarded moment, his actions revealed an assumption that a female colleague should do his bidding. And that story is told by a researcher called Patricia Yancey Martin, and she's done a lot of research into gender within organisations and how that plays out and so on. And so she talks about that statement that I used earlier on. She talks about the importance of catching the sayings and doings of gender, catching the sayings and doings of gender, becoming more aware of the ways that women and men relate to each other, particularly in our instinctive reactions and in our unguarded moments. It's possible to say and think all the right things about gender equality, the equality of men and women, but then to act differently because patterns of behaviour, the influence of our childhood, can be really deeply ingrained. And so we need to respond to the reality of what we're actually saying and doing, not what we say that we believe or that we say that we ought to be doing. Because gender is created and recreated by our actions and interactions with each other. It's not something that happens to us, but something in which we participate intentionally or not, but it's also something in which we can have agency. So we can change the way that we respond to each other. We can respond to each other differently. And so we practice gender through our everyday interactions, and we can choose whether we are going to reinforce or subvert gender norms. And so we can strengthen or we dismantle the status quo by the way that we respond to each other. We can uphold gender norms or we can choose to disrupt them. We can perpetuate inequality or we can try and show that another world is possible. And that kind of catch the sayings of doings of gender is that moment when you're aware that something that you've just done is more than it looks like on the surface. Is perhaps responding to something within you or a pattern of behaviour and so on. So let me just give you a few more examples of that. I noticed this in myself when I read the story of Bluebeard in a book. And I grew up in the Brethren Church, which had very set roles for men and women, which they understood to come from the Bible. And so a summary of their worldview is that, you know, men made decisions and women made the tea, on the surface at least. And as a student, I kind of discovered feminism and went to a church where we looked again at what the Bible said. And so I came to a very different understanding of what the Bible said about men and women, for which I'm very, very grateful. And so when I got married, my husband and I decided that we wanted to share work and parenting. We were able to do that. We had two children who are now adults. When they were very little, we job shared. So we each spent time at home with them. We each spent time out at work, which worked really well for us. And so, you know, that's a little bit of background. I had kind of 20 years of trying to lead a life that was very much about gender equality and respect and all that kind of thing. And then I read the story of Bluebeard. And in summary, Bluebeard is a man who has a beard that is blue, which is a signal that, you know, there's something a little bit strange about him. And basically, he seduces a young woman and he takes her to be his wife. And she's very happy about this. They live in this massive castle together and everything is fine. Until one day, Bluebeard says to her that he's going to go on a hunting trip. And he says, you know, why don't you invite your sisters over to stay with you while I'm away for a few days? And he gives her the keys to the castle. And he says to her, you can go anywhere you like in the castle, apart from the room that is opened by this smallest key on the key ring. And she says, great, that sounds great, off you go. So off he went, off he went hunting. And her sisters came to stay. And the sisters were really excited about this opportunity to explore the castle. And so they set off exploring the castle and they opened every room that they could find. They, you know, one by one, they worked their way through the keys and, you know, they found the store where he kept all his guns, the another room where he kept all his money, all this kind of thing. They went all the way around the castle and until they were only left with this last little key. And the sister said, let's find the door that this key opens. And so they go to find the door and they find it in a basement hidden away down a corridor. And they open the key. They open the door with the tiniest key and they open the door. And inside the room are the bodies of Bluebeard's former wives. And they realise what this man is really like. And so they very quickly lock the door and they race up back through the castle. But the key starts weeping blood. threatening to give them away. And so they try and clean the key, they scrub it as hard as they can, and so on, but the key keeps weeping blood. And so in despair, because Bluebeard's about to arrive back home, the wife puts the key in the top of her wardrobe and hides it away behind a load of clothes. And then they go out to meet Bluebeard and try and, you know, make sure that everything's okay. But he knows that something has happened, and so he throws open the wardrobe, and all the blood has soaked down and soaked all her dresses and all that kind of thing. My reaction when I read that story really poleaxed me. My gut reaction was, she should have done what she was told. She should have done what she was told. So she shouldn't have gone exploring in the castle, or if she had, she should have kept the rules. She shouldn't have opened that little door. And basically what I was saying was that she should have ignored her instinct to find out what was really going on with this man, find out what he was really like. She should have ignored that instinct. She should have obeyed this murderous man, and she should have, you know, stayed in threat of her life. Actually, in the story, everything turns out all right. Her brothers arrive and rescue her and put to death Bluebeard and all that kind of thing. So it all turns out okay. But I was really flummoxed by my reaction to that. And that's what I mean by that kind of catching the sayings and doings of gender. Here was I, somebody who prided myself on, gender equality, on kind of working through stuff from the past, trying to be somebody who, you know, explored my gifts, did different things and so on. And yet I was saying that this woman should have obeyed her murderous husband. And so that, in me, started a bit of a journey of thinking, why did I respond in that way? Now, clearly, you know, the influences of my childhood were still there. And those kinds of things have run very deep, and they're quite difficult to uproot. But we do need to do that. Another example of when I was writing my book on equality stuff, I asked people for examples of how they were living life. You know, how were people working out equality in different areas? Somebody I spoke to said that, you know, she and her husband had decided that they wanted to share work and parenting. And so they were doing this thing of they each had a job. They each spent some time with their children, and they each had 2 days off a week. One day overlapped, so I think it was a Saturday. They were both off together, and so they would all spend time together as a family. But then they each had a day off when the other person worked. And she says, so on my husband's day off, he'll sit and read the paper, and you know, he'll perhaps go for a run, perhaps watch a film, catch up on TV that he's missed. And she said, on my day off, I clean the house, I go and do the shopping, I do some ironing, I do the washing. She said, I can't just sit down like he does and read the paper. I just feel so guilty. And so we talked about that a little bit more. And again, that's a moment to kind of catch, isn't it? If you're saying that you want to share things equally, and yet in practice you're not doing that because you feel that guilt, what's going on there? What is it that's stopping you from, really enjoying that equal sharing? What's stopping you from taking on that burden of domestic work in the house? And I meet that in so many women. So many of us, work and then also do the second shift when we come home of keeping the house going, even though there are other adults in the house that we could share that with. And sometimes that's not because we've consciously sat down with each other and said, how are we going to organise life? I know, I'd like to work full time, and I'd also like to look after the house and do everything so you don't have to do anything. It's just assumptions that we make and patterns that we fall into. And we need to catch ourselves in those and ask why. Why am I doing this? If you want to do that, that's fine. If that's a gift that you're offering somebody, if you want to, do everything for everybody in your house, so brilliant. But often we don't do that because we want to. We do it because we've kind of fallen into these patterns. And then a third story of a friend of mine who is a vicar. And when she was in her first parish, so she'd been through the whole selection process of the Church of England, where, she'd felt a calling to priesthood, and she'd had people affirm that in her. So she'd been through the selection. Other people said, yes, we think you're called to the priesthood. And so she'd gone through training, she'd done a curacy at a church, and so now she had her first parish of her own. And she, in the early days when she was there, she went to see a local minister of a Baptist church, actually, to say, you know, what's your church doing? Tell me a bit more about the area. It'd be really good if we could work together here because our churches are quite nearby. And he told her that he couldn't work with her because she was in sin as a woman in leadership. And he said that he would meet with her as long as his wife was present as well, because it would be dangerous for him to meet with her as a woman on their own. Who knows what might have happened? So, you know, she did have a meeting with him, with her, his wife, as a chaperone in the corner, knitting. But, you know, he said he couldn't work with her because, you know, it was a sin for her to be a woman in leadership. And she was left feeling really shaken and questioning whether she was doing the right thing. Even though she was good at her job, she'd been through that selection process, all that kind of stuff, that encounter with that man really unnerved her and unsettled her. Again, that's a moment to catch, to say, what's going on here? What's going on here? I think many women will find that knowledge that other people think you shouldn't be doing what you're doing is really undermining, and we need to be aware of the impact that has on us. So it's really important for us to talk about what it's like to be men and women and our experiences. Now, I've given you examples of women, but I think the same is true for men. I think the same is true for examples of privilege as well as disadvantage. So there are some ways in which, as a white woman, you know, I experience privilege that other people wouldn't. And that in itself can be very telling. But what I'd like us to do is to get into little groups of twos and threes and talk about those things. Talk about your experiences of being men or being women. Now, you can choose how vulnerable you want to make yourself. You can choose whether you talk to somebody that you know or you talk to somebody that you don't know at all. And what I want you to do is just for one person to tell a story. And I'm going to suggest some questions you might want to explore. But one person to talk, and then the other or however many in the group just to listen. So if you're listening, you can ask clarifying questions, but you don't need to fix anything. You don't need to solve that. You don't need to sort it out. You don't need to overlay your own experience on it and tell them how you've done exactly the same. You don't need to belittle or contradict or say, well, that's not very important, is it? So your job is just to listen and to hear and to hold that experience that person has shared with you. What might you want to talk about? Well, in a moment, in The Guardian recently, there was a list of 10 sexist scenarios that women often experience at work. Reading down the list, I had only experienced one of them, and it wasn't actually at my work. And I say that because my boss is sitting here in the room. So, I'm aware of how privileged I am, and that's partly being an older woman, I think, partly working in the voluntary sector. But I have that list. I'd forgotten to get it out of my bag. I will get it out in a minute. So I've got that list, and so that might give you an idea of what something you might want to talk about, because you might have had one of those experiences. So I'll put them on here if you want to come and get that. But other kind of questions that you might want to talk about is, when have you felt it's an advantage to be a man or to be a woman? When have you felt it's an advantage to be the sex that you are? Or when have you felt that it's a disadvantage? So when have you thought, you know, if I wasn't female, I'd be treated differently, or if I wasn't male, I'd be treated differently? Or where do you experience inequality as a man or a woman? Do you feel under pressure to be a certain type of man or a certain type of woman? So those are the kinds of questions to talk about. Hopefully, as I've been talking, you've been thinking of some things, I don't know. But get into twos or threes, not really big groups, because it will take too long to share, and tell some stories. Let's try and catch the sayings and doings of gender, and then we'll get a bit of feedback from you. Thank you. Okay, if you could just draw those conversations to a close. People have obviously got lots of examples and things to talk about. Okay. It'd be really interesting if someone could go around with the roving mic just to hear what kinds of things you were talking about. So I don't want you to retell the whole story, but just perhaps sum up in a sentence or two the incidents that you were talking about. What kinds of things were coming out? A few people would like to tell us.
Hi, I'm 43 now. When I had my first child when I was 30, my husband and I did a deal. I was on a good career path. So I said, okay, I'm going to do 5 years part-time. And then I went to get back on the path. And so this is my experience of inequality. My husband thought that was a good deal. He wasn't quite so career-minded, still isn't. And when the time came, he asked his employer to go part-time. And they said no. And within a year, they made him redundant.
Right.
I'm still working part-time 10 years on.
Right. Thank you. I think that is quite common. Actually, you know, things have got a lot better for women with flexible working. But in some sectors, not true for all, it is really frowned upon for men to work less than full-time and overtime. You know, if you're seen as not wanting to be completely committed to the organisation, then, you know, you're on your way out, which is obviously your experience. So thank you. Other things?
Hi, I'm Harry. We were talking about the structural, the kind of social political dimensions of gender inequality and also the nature of discourse, because a lot of what we were talking about, kind of hearing from you, Jenny, was about kind of interpersonal stuff. And we kind of recognised all of the interpersonal relationships and interactions operate within this kind of bigger social political context. So just to kind of two examples, we were talking at the end about, you know, bacteria, the kind of traditional model, just kind of think about discourse and the kind of conceptualizations we have in this world, that we kind of think about bacteria, the kind of very traditional, what I kind of think is a very male driven model, is we kind of annihilate bacteria, wage war on them, kill them. And actually Janet was talking about these kind of alternatives of working collaboratively, these kind of new cleaning products that say actually the kind of natural world exists, you know, coexists with bacteria, and that's kind of legitimate, and our ways of working with them. You know, one example I kind of used was hearing about the story of Bluebeard. And, you know, it's kind of saying, you know, at the end of the story, you say it kind of ends okay and the brothers coming in, you know, they slay Bluebeard. But actually that still defaults to this kind of, you know, very male aggressive model of understanding the world.
Yes.
So those are just kind of two things we're talking about.
Okay, lovely. Thank you very much. Yep. Anybody else? Let's have a couple more examples of stories on there.
I'm a truck driver delivering heavy steel, and I don't fit into the stereotype that people expect. And we were just talking about how Nadia Boltz-Weber, her write-up says she swears like a truck driver.
Does it? Yeah.
I make a deliberate effort not to swear at work.
Right. Thank you. Brilliant. One down here.
Hi, I was just sharing about being on a committee actually at church for the rebuilding project, and the number of times that I, as one of three women on a committee of 15, can say something that apparently never left my mouth, because I said it and nothing happens, and then 2 minutes later, one of the men says it, and suddenly it's vitally important.
Yep.
Exactly, yes.
Yes, yeah. Thank you very much. That is the one on the list, actually, that I've encountered. You know, I've been in a board meeting and said that. And there's a very funny cartoon that is, you know, sort of a number of men sitting around a board table with one woman. And the caption is, "Thank you for that suggestion, Miss Triggs. Perhaps one of the men here would like to make it." So, yes. Thank you. So we could hear a lot more, and there will be a bit of time for questions in a moment. But I hope that's been an interesting experience and helpful. And I would like to encourage you to keep doing that. And I think, Harry, you're right that it's we're talking about interpersonal interactions, aren't we? And in the grand scheme of things, you know, that isn't on its own going to get gender equality in Parliament. But if all of us are interacting that way and changing the way that we interact with each other, and then passing that on to the next generation, if we're transforming our families, our workplaces, our churches, actually that will ripple out and have an effect. So other stuff needs to happen as well. I'm not suggesting that telling stories will on its own transform everything, but I do think it's really important, and that we catch those discrepancies in ourselves. And then we need to decide how we're going to respond to each of these things. And some of those things, perhaps we can't do very much about. But where we can, I think we need to act. And sometimes that is just a bit of self-reflection and thinking, OK, well, how would I do that differently another time? Sometimes it is really helpful to talk through with a friend. Sometimes it's good to address some of the issues. So I can remember another organisation that I worked for a long time ago, finding it very, very difficult to communicate with one particular male colleague. And so I went and got some assertiveness training, which was, that's a bit of a stereotype thing, isn't it? But it was really, really helpful. So, you know, there are things that we can do. But we can also, you know, choose how we respond in the moment. And so, you know, as I was saying, I had that example of being on a board, making a suggestion, and then, you know, 5 minutes later, a man said the same thing and got a big round of applause kind of thing. You know, how do you respond to that kind of thing? I could have said at the end of the meeting, actually, there's always any other business. I could have just drawn attention to that and said, I don't know if anybody else noticed, but this happened. Because that particular organisation is one that prided itself on wanting to be gender equal and wanting to encourage women and so on. So I could have done that. I had a similar experience many years ago. I was on a committee of a local Youth for Christ Centre. And this is when I was very young, actually. I was probably 22, not very confident. Went to this meeting. There weren't many women on this committee. And every time that I spoke during the meeting, one of the men would interrupt. And so, you know, I was trying to get things out, and they would always cut across me. And so I wasn't able to say what I wanted to say. And at the end of the meeting, I did say, very tearfully, actually, I got all emotional, and I did say what had happened in the meeting. And I said, you know, every time I tried to say something, one of you interrupted me. And to their credit, they listened and apologised. And we introduced this system whereby if somebody wanted to say something, they would raise a hand. And actually, that helped more people to contribute to the meetings other than those who actually found it really easy to jump in with their ideas. So we can choose, can't we, to sort of challenge things and try and respond in that way. And the final thing I'd like to say is to encourage us all to persevere with this kind of stuff and to challenging disadvantage where we see it in all areas of life, but I'm talking about gender particularly. Sometimes it can feel like, you know, are we still here? Are we still having to address this issue after so many years? But we are. And I mean, great that we will now have women bishops in the Church of England. That's not going to solve all the gender equality in the Church of England. There, you know, it's not going to be the end of the story. It's just going to be the beginning of another chapter. So we need to persevere in these things and keep going. So I often feel like I'm a stuck record and that people must get very bored with me going on and on and on about this kind of thing. But yes, let's persevere. So thank you very much for coming and for listening. Are there any questions? We've probably got about 8 minutes or so for people to ask questions.
Just to thank you for bringing up some of the stuff about gender stereotypes for men. It's been really refreshing to hear that said. When we talk about women getting the vote in 1918, let's remember that most of the working class men who'd been on the front, it was also the first time they could vote.
Mm. Yeah. Thank you. And I think, you know, I would just say to that we do live in a very patriarchal society. We all participate in that. But actually, I think men pay a high price for their participation in patriarchy because it's competitive, you know. So if you're not at the top of the tree, then, you know, you're a loser. So I think we need to be aware of those kinds of things as well. Thank you.
There's some ongoing discussions in our local congregation about the role of single-sex groups within the church. I'm a member of the Methodist Church, and the women within the Methodist Church have always had a strong group. And in our local congregation, which is probably pretty much 50-50 and of all ages, there's all women's groups and there are all men's groups. And as I say, there's some ongoing discussion about whether or not there's any role for these anymore. And I just wondered what your thoughts were. And I have mixed thoughts on that because having worked with vulnerable women in all women groups, I see the real benefit of them.
I mean, I run a group that's for women.
Some of the all women's groups in the church.
Exactly. I run one called the Gathering of Women Leaders. And so it is for women, but it's for women in leadership. So it's for a particular subgroup of women. I think one of the things about single-sex stuff is that we need to recognise that it won't cater for all women or all men. It will cater for a kind of a subgroup. So I think there is a place and a time for those. But we need to be very specific about what they're for. And I think it's good for them to be time limited, you know, so to achieve a particular purpose and then perhaps to move on. But you're right, you know, sometimes I look at there's a church near me that runs a men's group. And, you know, they go on long bike rides and, you know, canoe trips and all that kind of thing. I think I'd love to do that, you know, but I wouldn't want to go to the women's groups at that particular church because they're kind of those issues and tissues type women groups that I'm not particularly interested in. So I think there is a time and a place, but I think we need to be quite careful to think through that and think why. And I would say that particularly for young people. So I think, again, there is a time and a place for those, but actually we need to be getting young people to learn how to relate to each other well as boys and girls, young men and young women. And if we're keeping them apart in separate groups, they're not going to learn how to do that. So I think sometimes, and again, I've been involved in the past in leadership training for young women, but actually I think it'd be brilliant if young women could learn how to be leaders alongside young men. Actually keeping them separate says there's something different about them, and you know, actually if they can participate fully, it's better to train young people to as boys and girls as leaders, but sometimes some girls need a bit of help, that kind of perhaps that assertiveness thing, before they can fully participate. So there, yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yes, thank you. That's a very good point. Yes, and that's something that isn't particularly addressed in the church, I think, very often. So, yes, you know, if we, you know, why not have groups around a particular interest or a particular theme that people can choose to go to?
Just a question kind of about chivalry and courtesy and whether you think it's ever okay, you know, for people to say they're being sort of polite and courteous, maybe hold a door open or offer a coat to someone who's cold, and whether we can sort of draw a line between someone being polite and courteous to someone else and actually acting in quite a sexist or patronising manner.
Yeah, I mean, I'm all for kindness. I think kindness is a great thing, looking out for each other. You know, I'm always very flattered if somebody offers me their seat on the tube, but I very rarely take it because I feel like I don't particularly need it. So it's nice to be offered. So I think, you know, perhaps seeing generosity and things like that is a good thing, and offering it, but making sure we offer it to everybody. So, you know, there's no reason why, as a woman, you know, I should expect to have a seat on the tube more than a man should. If I'm pregnant, then yes, I think those baby on board badges are brilliant so that you can identify who's pregnant and who might need to sit down. But, you know, otherwise, so you don't say to somebody who's a bit large, would you like a seat? or when's your baby due, whatever. So, you know, I think that's great. But I think you're right that sometimes that can be offered in a way that is belittling and that is patronising. It's quite hard to discern, and it's about perhaps, you know, the wider interactions with that person. So I would say try and, you know, be generous in what we read into what people are offering. But yes, it is possible, yeah, for that to be done in a way that's not very kind. What? Yeah, one more question.
I'd like to talk about a conversation that I had last year at another Christian festival called Momentum, and it was with a group of actually mainly women, mm-hmm. and this conversation turned to gender equality, and I ended up making some points, and there was a number of women that just didn't want to hear anything about it, and they just thought, one of them said that women want to be looked after, mm-hmm. and men want to be the ones who look after them, and I thought, well, that may be the case for individuals, but that's such a stereotype, and it got to me that she just didn't want to hear and acknowledge that there was a problem at all. Mm. I just want to know, like, how do we deal with sometimes when women can be their own worst enemy?
Yeah, I was talking to somebody yesterday who's recently become a leader in her church. So she's, you know, kind of been appointed as one of the leaders, and she said 10 people have left the church as a result, and they're all women. Because they don't want to be led by a woman. And so they've gone to a church where they only have male leadership. So, you know, it is, definitely happens. I mean, I think you're right in perhaps the challenge to that is that some women want to be looked after, but most women don't need looking after, actually, just as most men don't need looking after. You know, we can kind of work together. And I think, you know, that kind of attitude of women need looking after, men need to do the looking after, can really infantilise women and, you know, kind of keep them dependent, keep them kind of underdeveloped. But it is quite difficult when you come across that in somebody. And perhaps the thing to do is to carry on having those conversations with them. But to point out where what they're saying isn't true, and to point out the people who don't want to be like that. So, you know, for example, I think it's always very good talking about your own experience. So, you know, if someone were to say that to me, I suppose I could talk about then, you know, what I've chosen to do with my life and so on. So that's something that you can do. But it is interesting how strong that can sometimes be, particularly in the church. And again, I think that's, you know, because some of the teaching, some of the examples that people have, a particular leader's kind of, you know, perpetuating those kind of stereotypes and kind of overlaying kind of a God perspective on it, which can be quite difficult to challenge, but I think it's important that we do. So thank you very much for that. We've run out of time. Thank you very much for coming.